This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The end of life presents tough challenges for all of us. This can be especially true for veterans who often struggle with feelings of guilt, abandonment, and regret. For some dying service members and their families, a military hospital is a place where they can make the most of those final days and prepare themselves for the inevitable. Patricia Murphy's been reporting on the end-of-life care for veterans as part of the American Homefront Project. Patricia works for public radio station KUOW in Seattle. The American Homefront Project is a collaboration of several public radio stations that focuses on our nation's armed forces. Patricia Murphy, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hi, good morning.
Tell us about the end-of-life care for veterans and a bit about the VA and Army hospitals you visited.
Yeah, well, I was able to visit VA facilities in Puget Sound and also Madigan Army Medical Center, which is located right outside of Joint Base Lewis-McChord here in Tacoma, Washington. The thing about Madigan Army is because it's an Army hospital, everybody there pretty much is an active duty service person. The doctors are often still active duty. The chaplain there is active duty. In particular, the palliative care support team there has one or two people who are civilians on that team, but everyone there is active duty. And that can be culturally very appropriate for people who are at the end of their life, and in some cases who are younger, who have been either stricken with cancer or dying, who are still active duty service members. And at the VA, a lot of those people are also veterans. So that care there can also be appropriate.
You know, we think about end-of-life issues and the challenges we face. We think about that. That is the moment in which sort of everything is stripped away and we're all faced with those same ultimate questions. But what are some of the differences and how are those challenges different for veterans, and maybe particularly combat veterans?
Yeah, especially in the case of combat veterans and some of the older ones, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. These are people who had very different experiences at war. The World War II generation, the greatest generation, you know, was very pro-government. The guys from Korea, from what I understand from studies I have read, very unresolved about that war. Vietnam, a lot of those people who fought in Vietnam don't feel they are resolved at the end of their lives. They often struggle with unaddressed post-traumatic stress disorder because we really didn't start talking about that the way we do now until, you know, after the Gulf War, at least. There can be a lot of unresolved feelings. A lot of older veterans who have been struggling with these issues have substance abuse issues. They're estranged from their families. A military setting at the end can be extremely appropriate and meaningful to them to help get their head around some of these issues that remain unaddressed. And you're right when you say that this end of life is vulnerable. So as vulnerable as it is, many of the chaplains that I spoke with told me that it is equally fruitful.
Well, and among them was a chaplain named Erin McCardle at Puget Sound VA. Here's what she had to say about working with vets nearing the end of their lives.
I actually find a lot of hope in the work that I do. I find that more often than not, maybe families that have been estranged and there's been a lot of pain are willing to come alongside and kind of let go whatever has been, whatever hurts have been, and just be present with their loved one in their time of death.
And Erin is like many chaplains who I visited with. She enters these situations listening to the veteran. She is there to meet people where they are in this moment of time, whether it's early in their palliative care or days and hours before their death. Wherever they are is where she is with them. And that, to her, is one of the most important things that they can do for veterans, especially the ones who don't reach that point of resolution at the end of their life. Erin and the palliative care team at the VA promise they will not abandon you at the end of your life.
That has to be one of the biggest fears, particularly for people who've served in combat, who've relied so much on at least one partner or their battalion or their unit to back them up and to be with them. And I wonder if there's something about the job itself. You talked about the unresolved conflicts that one might, psychological conflicts in post-battle. But also, the job itself requires that you be independent, that you be strong, that you not die. That's your job, is not to die. And I wonder if that makes things more difficult for these veterans at the end of their lives.
Well, what especially comes up at the end of their lives, you know, is that maybe they didn't live up to that promise. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they left a battle buddy behind. Maybe they didn't feel like the warrior ethos is ingrained in so many military service members for life. And at the end of life, there are feelings of failure that can be addressed. And the role of chaplain can be so instrumental in that. And I say this because chaplains are embedded with Army units. Chaplains throughout your career are the people you can go to and say the things in confidence, you know, and get guidance.
So their training as chaplains, as people of the cloth, but also the fact that they've been in combat and have a direct, you know, experience of this makes them well suited, I guess, for that particular job. Well, Patricia, I know you've also been reporting on MIA issues as well, particularly a Navy lieutenant that went missing in the Vietnam War. Tell us more about Lieutenant Kelly Patterson.
Kelly Patterson was attached to the USS Enterprise. He was shot down over Vietnam, north of Hanoi, from what I understand, by a surface-to-air missile 48 years ago this month. And he was a highly trained pilot. And it's a mystery about what happened to him that day.
Well, you've talked to Kelly's brother, George Patterson, who also served in the Vietnam War, and you have tape of him, and we're going to play a little clip right now because he seems pretty unconvinced about the stories that while many treat Kelly Patterson as someone who died in action or maybe shortly after, he's not convinced. Here's George Patterson, Kelly's brother.
They didn't break their silence on my brother for 18 years. They finally acknowledged that they knew something about my brother. They sent home his ID card and his Geneva Convention card, and we started getting reports about it, you know, about what they claimed happened to my brothers.
That was George Patterson, Kelly Patterson's brother. Tell us about that. There have been efforts, of course, to find out. And he was a navigator, I understand, on the plane that went down. The pilot was taken as a prisoner of war. Tell us more. What details do we know about their shooting down and what happened to both of them?
Well, there was a sense that Kelly had also been taken as a prisoner of war. The last messages his unit had from him, his squadron had from him, was that the Vietnamese were close, that he had destroyed his radio, which is protocol. If you feel like you're going to be captured, destroying the radio is what you need to do. When 15 years later, the Vietnamese government sent back his Geneva Convention card, sent back his military ID card, and claimed that Kelly had been killed in a firefight, that he stood up and shot at Vietnamese soldiers and was killed and buried on the spot. This seems implausible to Kelly's brother, George, who likes to be called Luck. Luck says that they knew that Kelly had a badly broken leg from ejecting from the plane. It is unlikely he was able to stand up. He says it is likely that Kelly may have fired because that was the kind of guy he was. He was terrified of being captured as a prisoner of war. But Kelly eventually, the brother eventually returned to Vietnam to search this area with a team from the United States. And what they determined, not only did they not find anything, but that the soil strata had not been disturbed, that it was very unlikely, given the information that they had, that Kelly was buried at this point. There is another theory that is out there. Kelly was a very highly trained pilot. The A-6 Intruder was the cutting-edge aircraft for its time. He was a valuable asset in terms of his knowledge. There is a theory he was taken to Russia and used for his knowledge. You know, his brother is very practical about the fact that it is unlikely that Kelly is alive. He really just wants the peace of knowing where his brother's remains are.
And the family,
and that haunts him.
Well, and a family held a memorial service, and maybe you can describe that for us.
Kelly's squadron mate, Dave Cable, has also been haunted by this. He was surrounding that radio that day that Kelly went down, and for years he had been hauling around this shattered windshield of an A6, which was a relic from his days in the Navy. And three decades go by, and he's still hauling this thing around. And a friend of him says, "You know, don't take that to the dump. That's an important piece." And because Kelly had been such a good friend and such an important part of his life and something that, quite frankly, has haunted him, he decided that this was the time and this is what he needed to do, was turn this into a commemorative memorial for his friend. And what they were able to do, which is extraordinary, was to have this ceremony in Friday Harbor, Washington, but to get a flyover from the Navy Growlers. Mm. These are $80 million planes. You know, they don't take them out for birthday parties. So for the folks who were present, this was extraordinarily meaningful and an acknowledgement, an official acknowledgement by the Navy that this is an important part of our history that needs to be honored.
All right. Great stories. Patricia, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Patricia Murphy is a military reporter for KUOW in Washington. It's part of the American Homefront Project. American Homefront Project is a collaboration between WUNC and two other public radio stations, KUOW in Seattle and KPCC. They focus on issues related to the nation's armed forces. You can find a link to Patricia's story and more information about the American Homefront Project at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, former NNO columnist Peter Zane talks about his career as a writer on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.